Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Matthew Holt. He is the co-founder of the Health 2.0 conferences, which are now owned by HIMSS, founder of the healthcare blog, president of smack.health, a healthcare startup advisory service, co-chair of Catalyst at Health 2.0, which runs challenges, codathons, and related programs, and is a self-described curmudgeon in the world of health technology. The world needs more curmudgeons, Matthew, so stay skeptical. We skeptics need to stick together, don't we?
The world probably actually doesn't need more curmudgeons. It probably needs fewer of us, but we'll be dying out soon.
Okay. Well, yeah, we can argue about that later as curmudgeons. So over the past 10 years or so, Matthew, graybeards like us have seen the world change, particularly in the realm of digital health, or since I know you have issues with that term, in health technology or in SMAC health. SMAC as an acronym that hits key components of this field of endeavor. Social and sensors, mobile, analytics, cloud, and of course, kindness. Now, investment in this field has grown from next to nothing to about $11 billion a year across about 600 deals a year, depending on how you count things. But the real question is, so what? What has this technological sea change done to change healthcare? Because Lord knows the healthcare system needs changing. And there are many levers being applied to try to change it for the better. So, Matthew, how is the technology lever doing in your estimation? And what else needs to be brought to bear on the system as we know it?
Wow. It reminds me of, I just came back from Japan, and they used to have a law in Japan. I think it was called the Denko Law. I may have got this name completely wrong. It's one of these books I read in political science in 1989, 1990. Anyway. In Japan in the 80s, there was a law that if you wanted to open a big retail store, like a grocery store or whatever, in any area of town, you had to get the agreement of all the local shopkeepers to let you open it. So think about that for a minute. So the big grocery stores had these guys, I think they were called the Denko men, I forget the name, but had these guys who were like their negotiators with the local mom and pop store owners.
Right.
And these guys, apparently they needed to have two attributes. They needed to be able to drink a lot, and they needed to be very, very patient. So I was told by one of the Japanese guys I was talking with about this extremely bizarre rule. And I kind of think of the US healthcare system as being like all those mom and pop stores who have somehow got this ability to delay, deflect, and stop quote unquote progress. You may or may not want to, you know, big grocery stores to take over your local mom and pop stores, but that tends to be the way the world and progress and what have you. And for regulatory, cultural, and other reasons, they were able to stop it for a long time. And that's kind of what's been happening in healthcare. Now, having said that, I just went back to Japan this year, and that 30 years on, things have changed, or 28 years on, things have changed, and there are lots of big retail stores in Japan, and that kind of thing is over, and hopefully that'll be where we end up with healthcare. So having said that, the problem we've got is, you mentioned, you know, the $10 billion a year, or whatever, $11 billion a year, Startup Health said is, or $5 billion a Rock Health say, or whatever the number is, and that is some number, but I mean, don't forget, we're talking about investment into companies that are in a system or a series of systems, or how we want to describe healthcare, that's what, $3 trillion, $3.5 trillion, depending who you believe. Even personal healthcare is around $2.8 trillion, so a big number. Even if you take out things like construction and research and development, whatever, which get lumped into that $3.5 trillion number. I guess the answer is it hasn't been that much. And by the way, most of that investment in the, okay, I hate the term digital health, but let's use it because that's the term everyone knows. The digital health sector.
We won't tell anyone.
Okay, well, I guess anyone who listens to this, they'll figure it out. We'll have a separate discussion about SMAC health and what we should call this stuff. I don't think that's a good answer, but, you know, we're talking about the new part of the health tech sector, whereas the bit of the health tech sector which got the real investment in the last decade was, of course, the old world, the client server tools that were put into every hospital, every doctor's office in America during the expansion of EMRs and the meaningful use under the High Tech Act. And that got like about $35 billion of government money over just in a few years. So, you know, $10 billion or so of government money a year, plus a ton more put in by the system, you know, in terms of training and, you know, probably 3 to 4 times that to do EMRs, which were, as I think we'll all agree, more or less paving the cow path of how the healthcare system had operated up to then.
Right. But it's also, in a sense, it's a foundation for all of this new investment and activity. If we don't have the bits and bytes, then we don't have the ability to extract meaning and apply something useful to the system.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And I think that there is a lot to be said for that. And this is the David Blumenthal argument as to why they didn't do interoperability, where they just put computers out there and EMRs out there and didn't really worry too much about it. He was the head of ONC at the time when all the money was spent, or the first one before Farzad Mostashari. And he said, you know, that's what we had to do. We had to spend the money quickly, and we wanted to ramp it up and get computers out there. And we would sort out that interoperability and using the data later. However, what it's also done is it's installed, it happened at the same time as we saw a continued big consolidation of health systems, particularly hospitals, you know, acquiring other hospitals and acquiring physician practices to shore up the base. So it was the installation of these EMRs tracking activity that was already going on. And as you and I both very well know, and the folks at Dartmouth starting, God, 50 years ago with Jack Wenberg, a long time ago with Jack Wenberg, have pointed out, what's been going on in those big health systems has not been necessarily the best delivery of care in terms of how you would create a care system for a big population if you were starting from scratch, because they're focused on hospital beds, specialists doing procedures rather than primary care, prevention, all that nice good stuff that we hear about, number one. And number two, there's huge amounts of practice variation between them and huge amounts of pricing variation between them. And latterly, huge amounts in both your fair city and my fair metro area, you have two of the biggest players being accused frequently of aggressive pricing manipulation against payers. You know, both I'm thinking, I'm talking about Partners here in Sutter. So we kind of, like I said, paved the cow path we might not want to do with paved. But on the other hand, I kind of agree there wasn't that much alternative. The interesting thing about the next 10 years, I'm sure we'll talk about this, is what is the alternative in terms of how we can deliver care and what kind of technology is going to help us do that.
So let's get into that. Do we need to rip up the paving of the cow paths? Some implementations actually worked on redefining workflows before paving them in the electronic systems, but others did not, of course. So what needs to change in the future in order for all of this to work?
So Indu and I, my partner at Health 2.0, conference side and Catalyst have talked about this for a while. And we started talking about something last year called flipping the stack. And I think that means that the cow paths are going to have, you know, highways built around them. If the cow paths go through the villages and you can do a direct highway one way, you know, going past, doing bypass, as the British call it, a bypass around the village, right, from one place, from town to town, that's probably what we'll end up doing eventually. But it's going to take a long time. So what the hell do I mean by that? So I think in gross generalization, we had care delivery, you know, thousands of years of doctors and then hospitals with patients showing up at the doctor and the hospital, getting stuff done to them, and then going away. Over the last 30 years, we've added, 40 to 30 years, we've added services, you know, people trying to figure out what happened when they, what other stuff needed to be done. And that's all the sort of nurse educators and diabetes and coaches, you know, phone coaches and all that other stuff that's kind of around there. And that's ended up, some of it's physical services like home health care and that kind of stuff. But it's really been predicated on that initial delivery system. And then in the last decade or so, 15 years, we've added technology on the top basically to track what's been happening. But it's still been based on a system that you and I well know makes all its money off that medical care, gets paid fee for service for that medical care, and gets paid for hospital admissions and doing expensive and extensive surgeries, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas most of the costs of the system are visited on a small number of people who have, in some cases, cancer, in some cases, trauma, but in most cases, long-term chronic illnesses, which could be both much better managed if there was sort of permanent surveillance and permanent management of them, and could probably reduce their costs because you catch stuff earlier before they get into the hospital, the classic case I remember is, you know, getting the person with diabetes on a balanced diet and on getting their blood sugar under control and, you know, getting their medications right, yada, 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 so they don't end up in hospital in the emergency room with a diabetic coma or end up having their foot exam, you know, their foot amputated or going blind or what have you. Now, I'm not going to belittle the vast difficulties we've seen in creating systems that do this kind of management, but you've got to assume that we've seen enough progress and enough trials where it has worked, and we know enough times, you know, that the failure of the system has been these hospital admissions, these emergency room visits, that there's a lot we can do that. So to do that, we have the potential, by no means the actuality, but the potential to what we call flip the stack, which is to say, all right, technology can now do a lot more than it used to be able to do. This is the new stuff. This is the digital health, the smart health, plus the new stuff, which hasn't really got out there yet, the artificial intelligence and the sensors everywhere and the virtual reality and all the other good stuff. Who knows? I'll say the word blockchain just because I can. But, you know, the new stuff. But now you've got to think about, all right, what do you actually want to do with those people? Do you want to try and detect who's got what as soon as possible, who's likely to get what as soon as possible? So do a whole lot of analysis over all different kinds of data sets. And then you want to be tracking these people as much as you can where they are, which is predominantly at home, at work, at home in the bathroom, when they're sleeping, when they're eating, what they're eating, and, you know, what they're doing. And that we're just getting the first generation of tools which do that kind of surveillance. And I know it's not a friendly word, but what I'm talking about here is creating a technology platform that is always on, always monitoring, always messaging, and then always managing. And I think we're going to move to that. And you can just start to see the first part of this, right? You've got to start to see the, God knows, there was an ad in the BART station I was at the other night for a toothbrush called Quip, which, you know, sends back information about you brushing your teeth to an app. We all now, many Americans have got Alexa in our home, which, you know, is we're asking questions of and pretty soon to be asking us questions. You've got Wi-Fi enabled blood pressure cuffs and scales and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You're pretty soon going to have tools in your bathroom you can blow into or breathe into or, you know, pee on top of, which are going to tell you a lot of data. You know, obviously then you've got all those things you can wear on your body or in your body to track what's, you know, the Apple Watch being a great example, the Fitbit Surge. But I mean, you can see that whole realm of sensor-enabled devices producing information, which will enable us to do this level of surveillance relatively cheaply. And then you can flip the stack and have the services sort of follow up with that. Now, you've been seeing companies now doing that. So I'll tell you one example I know well, which is Livongo, which kind of has a souped-up, informated blood glucose meter and now has got a wireless blood pressure cuff and a bunch of other. We'll have more soon, which has then got a bunch of nurses and educators on the phone who call when something goes wrong and can start directing traffic for those people with diabetes when there's some problems, right? So you can see those early stages. And I think if you go on, you can imagine a system where most people who have chronic illness, who are, for the people who are going to end up in the hospital, have that level of monitoring as a core part of their everyday life. And are being worked on in many different ways and are being helped in many different ways, including, you know, behavioral health issues and who knows what else. And where appropriate, visits to the house by professionals, of course, telemedicine, et cetera, et cetera. You can imagine that entire platform being created. And you can also imagine that it's not necessarily, it's probably unlikely that if it's going to happen, that it would be the traditional hospital systems who spend all that money putting in EMRs. And by the way, who are the people many of the digital health folks are selling to, who are putting this big technology platform in place. It's much more likely to be the current set of tech giants that, you know, we know well who are putting, you know, I mentioned Apple and Google and Amazon, and, you know, it's more likely to be people like that with a bunch of partners than it would be partners, Mass General and Kaiser. Although that's completely open to debate.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is Matthew Holt, health technology curmudgeon at large. Do you see those tech giants partnering with provider organizations, with payer organizations, or as value-based payment has started to take hold, people are now talking about payvider organizations, sort of a hybrid of provider and payer I understand your point about needing a technology partner, but is the point of entry on the provider side or the payer side, or do you think
it matters? This is a really good question. And the problem with this is where we get back to the shopkeepers in Japan, you know, for everyone the other bit with, because the regulatory mechanism for the shopkeeper is that there's Medicare fee for service, which is still 70-odd percent, 65-odd percent of Medicare. And then you have private plans through the rest of Medicare and the rest of the commercial world who tend to follow the Medicare fee schedule. And there's just been a bunch of changes to it around the margins about adding in payments for remote monitoring and what have you. But we don't have the big bang where we say, here's X dollars per person per year. You, the Medicare, you somebody go figure this out, how to deliver the most effective care as cheaply as possible, which would drive people much more quickly towards this kind of, you know, if it works, which I think it will do, much more quickly to this level of surveillance. So how does it get there? I mean, you know, it's easy to paint this picture of the future. It's harder to see how you make that transition. You know, we do have pay vital organizations, a big one in my neck of my woods called Kaiser. It's been around a long time. It's on the East Coast, it's Geisinger. There is, you can see people like Harbor Pilgrim in your neck of the woods with their connection with Atrius or Atrium. I can't remember which is which. Atrius is
Atrius
your,
up here.
Atrius in your town. Atrium is the one that just stole Rasu Shrista down in
North Korea. Right.
But I mean, Atrius is like a physician group that's wholly capitated, doesn't own any hospitals, and has only interest in doing that. That they're working with, for example, that hospital home company, Medically Home, to try and see if they can, you know, make it save money on hospital care or the care of patients who otherwise would be in hospital, right? And then you see startups like, so there's a very well-funded one called Diverted Health, which is the Park brothers, Todd, famous for being CTO at HHS in the US and also founder of Athena Health, and his brother Ed, also at Athena Health, and a bunch of other well-known sort of technorati in the healthcare space have put that together, raised $200 million out of Van Rock and Andreessen Horowitz, and are now starting a sort of their own payvider in Florida for Medicare Advantage. So you can see, you know, a bunch of vehicles like this. And I would suspect the most likely course of action is that somebody agrees to pay with this, whether it's a Medicare Advantage plan that takes a step outside, whether it's another financing vehicle, one of these new Medicare Advantage plans, like a Clover or something like that, who starts paying, or maybe, I don't know who's going to promote this, or maybe Medicare does some more experiments, where they're going to start putting the technology platform at risk, and whether it's Google plus a whole bunch of other people, or Amazon or Apple or a whole bunch of other people, or whatever the alliance that's put together to do this, putting those new organizations at risk. And then they would then contract out with services companies and eventually with, you know, inpatient and real doctors and inpatient facilities. But a lot of that stuff's going to happen much more in the home than it would be patients traveling out. And you've already got both the telemedicine people plus some telemedicine plus home visit people. There's a little company called Heal, which is doing that. And then you've got a whole bunch of other people trying to figure out new service models around delivering stuff into the home, including supplies, right? You've got Amazon buying PillPack and a bunch of other people trying to figure out how do you get those supplies in the home that you need them, whether they be pharmaceuticals, med devices, or what have you. So getting from here to there is certainly not easy, and it is dependent on the sort of pace of change of payment, which is torturously slow, as you know and I know. But I think it's more likely to come from a change, you know, the relationship between somebody who pays and, you know, this new sort of technology-enabled delivery system. That's my guess as to where it comes from first. Now, I may be totally wrong, and you may find the alternate, which is that some of the bigger names in healthcare delivery, maybe once they've got a payment component, like a UPMC or like a Kaiser, say, actually, that's what we're going to do. We're going to make sure that, you know, we take over that, and we flip our model, and we go and manage people in the home first. And maybe you see that first from one of them rather than from a tech company. They go and engage the tech companies or what have you. And I did notice that, I want to say Harvey Feinberg, was named, not Harvey Feinberg, Donald Feinberg, the guy who's just left, just leaving Geisinger to go to Google. He had an interview with Robbie Pearl on Robbie Pearl's podcast, another ex-Kaiser guy, ex-Permanente guy. In which he basically said, we have 13 hospitals and I'm going to try to figure out how to try and close all of them and do stuff at the home and send people to their home instead. And so the Kaiser, you know, sorry, Geisinger, or Geisinger as I often call them, is trying to figure this out, right?
The hospital is the most expensive place to be delivering care. The capital costs of a hospital are tremendous, but of course the staffing costs outpace even the capital costs.
Yeah.
So it's not just about It's not just about that. You mentioned UPMC before. UPMC in the past year announced the building of 3 new hospitals, none of which would have inpatient beds because they're focused on digital health and managing care on an outpatient basis. You know, a lot of what you're talking about...
Is that a hospital and what's the revenue flow for that? I mean, that's the question, right? Because if the revenue flow is you don't have, maybe you don't need a hospital. Maybe you need a... We call it a hospital because I don't think what else to call it, but it's a health, what used to be called health maintenance organizations, but I guess that's not quite got the zing we'd look for.
Right. Well, I mean, that's really what we're moving towards or hoping to move towards. And I mean, you've been talking a lot about chronic health conditions, Matthew, and a lot of the companies that you've mentioned are dealing with specific populations or age brackets or types of conditions. And I guess the question is, how much longer are we going to be experimenting around in little pockets within healthcare before we can expand this across the board to have sort of a unified field theory of healthcare and deliver coordinated care using the combination of technology and human touch in a way that makes sense beyond the scope of just a handful of chronic conditions?
Wow. I mean, longer than I think we'd like. You know, I think I'm discussing something that is at the stage of the theory. People like me and Chrissy Farr and you are drawing diagrams about what Amazon or Apple might do and how it might work.
Right.
And clearly there are people inside these organizations who are doing that as well. But it's going to be a while because healthcare moves so slowly because you can't put the incumbents out of business easily. You know, if you figure out a better way to sell books online and you can make it cheaper, faster, in a few years you can put Borders and Barnes & Noble in the corner, right? And then later on you can grow that and put every other retail player in America in a corner because people are voting with cash. People are voting with cash in healthcare, right? It's long-term contracts. It's the Medicare fee schedule. It's a bunch of ways. And it's you've got to change incentives. Then you've got to change the culture of those big institutions. And then you have to change the culture of the medical profession. Three very hard things to do. So it's a long time. It's not 5 years. But you can more than read the tea leaves now. You can start to see the building blocks come into place, how you can start to do this at scale. It's just been, as you know, incredibly hard to do anything at scale in healthcare, even to the fact that, don't forget, most healthcare systems are incredibly regional. They're the same as TV markets. It's as if, you know, you had 5 TV stations in every major metro area, or 8 or whatever it is, or New York, and 3 in smaller ones. But you had no ABC, NBC, or Fox, right? You didn't have that. You didn't have national programming. You just had the local programming. Everyone arguing about whose local programming was better and buying up the other TV stations in their neighborhood so you could only watch one or two channels. That's still where we've been. I'm not optimistic it's going to happen quickly. I'm just sort of painting a vision of where it could and I hopefully ought to go.
Sure. Well, to take a step on the path forward, let me ask you, if you were to wake up in 5 years from now, what is one thing you would hope or expect would be different in the world of healthcare?
All right. Well, let's do the hope. The hope is that I wake up 5 years from now with whatever chronic illness I probably have and probably incubating right now by talking to you and not going on the treadmill and drinking coffee and drinking, you know, some healthy fruit shake or whatever. I won't tell you about what I planned for lunch. I would hope to live in a world where I would stumble into my bathroom. I would stand on a scale. I would have the, you know, 9th iteration of Alexa or Google Home shout at me about what I'm doing. I would shout back. I would have a bunch of very easy testing done, you know, by blowing, by breathing into a sensor or something. That I would be, you know, if I had that level of chronic disease, that I would be monitored and given a day-to-day sort of idea about what to do and given a lot more help from these virtual assistants and AI. I mean, that's moving on very, very rapidly. I want to see the advance in that world be closer to what we've seen in self-driving cars in the recent last decade or so. So maybe 5-8 years, that's kind of what I'd hope. And that I would be part of a system where I would be poked and prodded, especially if I was an expensively chronic, potentially expensive chronic ill patient, poked and prodded in the nicest possible way, in a way that would encourage me to actually, you know, live my life a bit better and improve my health and certainly not go into a crash and end up in an emergency room. So that's kind of what I'd be hoping. And then my secondary hope would be that, given the news that Facebook just came out, you know, this week about the various levels of where the data has been, this is your world, taken, shared, used, monetized with no knowledge from the data generator, the individual consumer. I'd hope that we have clear ground rules about what it's good to share and what it's not going to share, what that data can be used for, who's seeing it, and so that people are confident that this level of surveillance, because it's going to be a huge level of surveillance compared to what we currently have, is actually good for their health and improves their lives and improves the lives of others with their diseases. I think we can get there, although clearly the last 2 years have shaken everyone's faith in the ability of certain tech companies, well, probably all of them, to use your data with some trust. I mean, that probably goes for not just tech companies, but all companies, and for that matter, the government. So I'm hoping that doesn't, that gets resolved and it doesn't derail my vision. But I kind of agree, 5 to 8 years out, this is still kind of a vision. I think you'll see people in that kind of situation, a relatively low percentage, you know, maybe 5, 8, 10, 20% of people with chronic illness who need that kind of surveillance having it. And then it'll be much longer before the whole system goes, aha, this really works. This is the way we deliver care in the future. And, you know, we get up that S curve and maybe it's in 20 or 30 years that everyone has that level of active management. And we're on what I call this tech platform that's, as I say, is always on, always measuring, always messaging, always managing.
Okay.
So that's my vision. And you know, hopefully it's right. But you know, I'm 55, but maybe we'll be dead before all this happens.
Oh, I hope not, Matthew.
I hope not too. But you know, I've been studying healthcare in the States since I was 30, so that gives me 25 years of actually no, sorry, since I was 25, that gives me 30 years of doing this. And you know, I made a lot of predictions about how things were going to change, and I'm now at the point where I realize, okay, it takes forever. Hope forever, not that long a time.
Well, until that all changes, you can listen to more discussion about it here. Thank you for joining us, Matthew. I appreciate it.
David, I really appreciate it. Appreciate all the work that you do in health technology and helping people with all that sort of confusing legalese stuff as well. And really enjoyed talking with you.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.